For this episode, I speak with John Perkins, best-selling author of several books, including the well-known Confessions of an Economic Hitman. In the Confessions of an Economic Hitman, you know, John goes over his time working for the strategic consulting firm Chase T. Maine during the 1970s. Working for this consulting firm, he was chief economist, where he and his staff advised the World Bank, United Nations, the IMF, U.S. Treasury Department, Fortune 500 corporations, as well as countries in Asia, Africa, Latin America, and the Middle East. And to give you an idea of what John did while working at this firm, I would like to quote his description of an economic hitman from his book, Confessions of an Economic Hitman. Economic hitmen, EHMs, are highly paid professionals who cheat countries around the globe out of trillions of dollars. They funnel money out of the World Bank, the U.S. Agency for International Development, and other foreign aid organizations into the coffers of huge corporations and the pockets of a few wealthy families who control the planet's natural resources. Their tools include fraudulent financial reports, rigged elections, payoffs, extortion, sex, and murder. They play a game as old as empire, but one that has taken on new and terrifying dimensions during this time of globalization. I should know. I was an economic hitman. One of the fun things about this podcast is that I get to connect with so many different people. I get to set up interviews and have conversations with some very interesting, prolific authors and thinkers and philosophers and activists and people of, you know, just doing whatever they want to do with their life and pursuing it. And I was fortunate enough to have this conversation with John. It was a short conversation. It only lasted about 30 minutes. He had a pretty strict time frame that we had to work within. The thing is, though, that we recorded this conversation about 2 months ago, and I resisted releasing this episode for that time, for some time, because I felt slightly embarrassed, because, you know, I think this conversation went really well, but there's one point in the conversation where this is something that I'm learning and getting better at, but there was one point, and you'll hear it in the conversation, where I basically just unload so much information. Like, basically what I was trying to do is ask him a question. And what ends up happening sometimes when I do these interviews is I have so many ideas running through my head that trying to narrow them down into a concise thought and question sometimes doesn't quite work out. So there's a point in this interview where you're going to hear John be like, whoa, okay, that was a lot. That was a lot. And I felt kind of embarrassed, honestly. So, you know, this podcast is a learning experience for me. I am learning how to conduct professional interviews and have conversations with people. And I think I'm doing okay. But like anything, you know, any project that you take on, it's a learning process. And you're going to make a few minor mistakes, large mistakes. In this conversation, we discuss his most well-known book, Confessions of an Economic Hitman, his role in this consulting firm, trying to basically working as a means to get the United States, its banks, financial institutions, corporations, to get their slimy little capitalist tendrils into every aspect of a nation's economy and basically suck it dry. And that's essentially what globalization is doing. And John was a part of that for some period of his life. And of course he got out of that. He wrote about it and now he's doing amazing work. He's an activist. He's doing the best he can, I think, to heal the wounds that capitalism has wrought, you know, has made on this planet and on the people on this planet. So, you know, in that, we also discuss how, because of his experience as someone who basically consulted South and Central American countries, right now Venezuela is undergoing a great deal of strife and turmoil. And I think that the U.S. media in particular is not doing a very good job of accurately describing what is happening there. You know, while I definitely agree that, you know, the government in Venezuela is very much not really serving the interests of the people, I think that the opposition that is trying to overthrow the reforms and the government, essentially, of Venezuela doesn't necessarily have the best intentions either. I think that the United States is very much involved in that. We know that the United States has attempted multiple times to overthrow the democratically elected government of Venezuela. And that oftentimes what happens is that there's a very small group of people. There's an elite group of people, the wealthy, the upper class in Venezuela, which has control over a lot of the economy. You know, they're trying to basically roll back all of the reforms and changes that has happened under the kind of the Bolivarian socialist program that was enacted under Hugo Chavez and now his predecessor, Maduro. So it's a very complicated situation. I think John gives a good explanation as to what's going on there. Again, we weren't able to get into too much depth regarding that, but I thank John for taking the time to hash out some of these ideas with me, for being patient with me as an interviewer. So thank you, John, and thank you all for listening. If you'd like to support this podcast, you can do so on the podcast Patreon page. Go to patreon.com/lastbornthewilderness. If you want to make very small monthly contributions to this podcast, you can gain early access to the conversations a week in advance. So I will be releasing the full episodes like I normally do for the general public. Everybody can have access to those conversations. But if you are a contributor, you'll gain a week early access to just the conversation. So you won't get this introduction. You won't get any of the things that I add on to the podcast. You're just going to get the raw conversation. So, and you can download it from there as well. And without further ado, I would like to move on to the conversation with John Perkins. Thank you.
Were you just recently in the Amazon? Is that right?
Yeah. Yes. Just got back a little less than a week ago.
Wow. How was that?
It's great. I love the Amazon. I've spent a lot of time there. I go at least once a year. This year, I've been twice this year so far. Take groups of people there and hang out with the indigenous people. Mm. It's a remarkable experience.
Yeah, sounds like it. Yeah. So, what work do you do there? Is it a part of your organization?
Yeah, the trip I just took was for the Pachamama Alliance, which I'm one of the three co-founders, along with Bill and Lynn Twist. And our organization takes people about once a month to work with and learn from the Achwa, who, when I was living in the Amazon and as a Peace Corps volunteer, the Achwa were uncontacted, considered very dangerous. Now they're our partners. Mm-hmm. And so our organization is a very close partnership with them, Pachamama Alliance. And once a year, the three co-founders take our major supporters, people who contribute money to the organization, on a special trip. And that's what we just did in there, to spend time with the people they're supporting, which is very nice.
Yeah. Do you, I mean, you know, of course, people know you as the person who wrote the Confessions of an Economic Hitman. And you've talked a lot about that. You've talked a lot about your experience with that. And now you're talking about what you're doing now. It's like, do you ever have those moments where you're just sort of in that, you're in the moment, you're doing what you're doing, and you think, man, how far that you've come, how far, like, how different your focus is now from what it used to be when you were younger?
Yeah, and actually, you know, I wrote 5 books on indigenous people and shamanism before Confessions of an Economic Hitman. So,
okay.
And I've been involved with these people forever, since I was a Peace Corps volunteer fresh out of college. But yeah, I do. And right now I'm sitting in a cottage on a lake in the forest of New Hampshire that my grandfather built 100 years ago. And I spent my summers here as a young man, as a kid, until I was 18. And I'm now here with my daughter, who's 35, and my grandson, who's 9. And it's really wonderful because, yeah, I'm able to look back to when I was his age and played in these forests and always had a desire to go to the Amazon, always had a desire. I had a great love of things like Tarzan and the Indian lore of this part of the world, the Last of the Mohicans, these kind of stories. And the Amazon is the only place on the planet where people still live very much like they did here in these forests. 200-300 years ago.
Wow. Yeah. Yeah, I bet that's it's a good experience to step outside of I guess civilization, if you want to use that term. You
know, I think I'm actually stepping into civilization.
Stepping into civilization.
Yeah.
Okay.
You know, those people, the indigenous people, have continued to live a sustainable life for thousands and thousands of years. And in the last less than 100 years, the civilized countries and societies of the world have managed to basically place themselves on the verge of extinction. I mean, we're coming, you know, I think we're going to pull through this, but we've done a terrible job. And the indigenous people are so much more civilized in terms of how they relate to the world around them.
Yeah, absolutely. I guess it really just comes down to the definition of that term.
Absolutely.
You know, it's actually kind of funny. I have a t-shirt, and it's there's this author named Chris Ryan, and he wrote a book called Sex at Dawn, and he's coming out with a new book called Civilized to Death. And so he released a t-shirt, and what it shows on it is a chimp, and it's in like a suit, like a, you know, a tailored suit with like an American flag lapel, and he's on a cell phone eating a cheeseburger. And the monkey, the chimp, has this look of distress, like on his face, and under it, it says Civilized to Death. And that's the name of his new book.
Mm-hmm.
And I like to wear it around because people have kind of interesting reactions, because I think just the idea of being civilized is totally different for different people. So it's interesting to hear your response to that. It's kind of funny to me.
Right.
But yeah, so, of course, you know, you're the work that you're most, you know, known for was, of course, Confessions of an Economic Hitman. And I know that you've talked about it a lot. I know that you've talked about it over and over again for years. But if you wouldn't mind just going over what that book was about, what your experience was, and what the, I guess really what the term economic hitman, you know, what is that exactly?
Yeah, well, I think it's fair to say that really, this period that we're in, which I call the period of a death economy, an economic, and it goes beyond that, economic, political, ecological, social system that is, in fact, consuming itself into extinction, destroying the very resources upon which it depends. It really is a death system that we have, and mm-hmm. we need to change that to a life economy. And I think it's fair to say that the death economy grew out of the work that economic hitmen did, people like me. My job, was to identify countries with resources our corporations want, like oil, arrange huge loans to those countries from the World Bank or Wall Street. The money never actually went to the countries. It went to our own corporations to build big infrastructure projects in the country, things that helped a few rich people in those countries, but mainly helped our own corporations and the rich people who owned the industries that benefited from electricity, from big highways and airports, the infrastructure that our companies built. But it really left the poor people much poorer and the middle classes mm-hmm. disappearing, because money was diverted from education, healthcare, and other social services to pay off the debt. And in the end, they never could pay off the debt. And so we'd go back and say, since you can't pay your debt, sell your oil or whatever resource real cheap to our companies without any environmental or social regulations. Let us build a military base on your soil, that sort of thing. So we really created this global empire. It's not really an American empire. It's a corporate empire. It's really run by big corporations. I mean, it's very clear today that President Trump is under the thumb of corporations. I mean, that's what it's all about, is helping corporations. That's really always been true. I mean, you know, Obama had to hire and ended up getting a lot of money from corporate donors and ended up hiring a lot of people from Wall Street to run many of his programs. But it's really become overt under Trump, and yet it's been part of our system for a long time. And incidentally, the few cases where we economic hitmen failed to convince governments to do these things, as I failed in Ecuador with President Jaime Roldós and in Panama with Omar Torrijos, in those cases, the jackals go in, what we call jackals, CIA-sponsored people who either overthrow government or assassinate the leaders. Both Roldós of Ecuador and Torrijos of Panama, my clients, were assassinated because they didn't play the game.
So I guess it's a little shocking, and not maybe not to me, but this sort of interplay between government agencies and corporate interests. Like, you're talking about working for a private firm that is essentially trying to, I mean, maybe people frame it as a business deal, but essentially you're coercing these nations and the leaders of these nations into taking these big deals, these loans, so that corporations, of course, can benefit from that. But like you said, if that doesn't work, then that's when the jackals come. That's when the CIA comes in. That's when there's coup d'etats. That's when military interventions may occur. And so it's a disturbing thing to to go back and think about is how there really is no actual separation anymore, or maybe there never was. Because even like, what was his name? Smedley Butler. He was that Marine back in the early 1900s. He fought for the U.S. Marine Corps. And I mean, he went to, I think, Haiti. He went down to Central America. And basically working as, you know, working for the U.S. military, essentially their role was to open up the market for fruit companies, for large multinational banks and corporations so that they can continue or, you know, exploit these countries and their resources. And that was way back in the early 20th century, before even World War I, I believe. And, you know, he came out with a kind of a scathing critique of that. I think it was called War is a Racket, which, of course, is just about how war is really just a way to generate profit. You know, it's like the system is playing itself out, and it's finally reaching the point of exhaustion. And like you pointed out with the people in the Amazon forest, how they're really the truly civilized people because they live in they've been living in balance with their local ecology and environment for countless years and generations. And our system, in fact, is doing everything it can to squeeze every last thing it can out of the world and out of its people and its living things to get whatever amount of capital it can out of that. And anyway, I guess with your job, so you know, something that's been on my mind and something I wanted to bring up to you, and I don't know how much insight you have into this, but you know, Venezuela has been in turmoil for a little while, and it's really been fascinating to see how the U.S. media has been portraying the events there, and how there have been journalists who have gone on the ground and have actually seen what's going on there, and that the reality of what's happening there doesn't exactly match up with the perception that we're supposed to have of what's happening there. And for what I can understand is that Venezuela is experiencing a lot of different issues, but one of them is that the elite and the very wealthy people in that country do not appreciate the reforms that happened under Chavez's government and now under Maduro. And they're doing everything they can to delegitimize this government and wage essentially a street war, like a battle with them. So I don't know if you had any thoughts on that. You know, what exactly happened there with Venezuela?
Wow, well, you just covered a lot. Before I go to Venezuela.
Sorry about that.
Before we go to Venezuela, going back to what you talked about, the relationship between government and corporations, I think that's a very, very important one. And that has a lot of impact and significance with Venezuela, too.
Yeah.
But I think it's important to understand that, you know, what we have is a new form of capitalism, which I call predatory capitalism. And if you look, capitalism, by definition, is an economic system or the government an economic system where the means of production and commerce are owned by individuals, by the private sector, not the government. So there's nothing inherently wrong with capitalism. Small markets in the Andes or farmers markets in the United States, those are capitalistic organizations where the commerce is owned by individuals, not by the government. What we now have in the United States, and it's impacting much of the world, is the opposite of that. We have a system where the government is owned by corporations. That's not capitalism. It's a form of capitalism. It's what I call predatory capitalism. It doesn't mean that capitalism in and of itself is bad, but this form of it is horrible. It's really bad. It's a system where these big corporations have so much power, they control the world. And they have a tremendous amount of power in Venezuela. I think a lot of, you know, one of the things that happened back in the 50s and 60s, Venezuela was by far the wealthiest country in Latin America per capita. It had more foreign investment than all the rest of Latin America combined, including countries like Argentina and Brazil. But oil really destroyed that country. It brought in tremendous amounts of wealth, and it brought in a lot of corruption. And we can blame local leaders for being corrupt, but we have to ask ourselves who corrupted them. And in the main, what corrupted them were the oil companies, the international oil companies. Then they were nationalized, and there was all this turmoil. And so there's always been this play. It's kind of like a teeter-totter in Venezuela of siding with the oil companies, taking a lot of money from oil, and then having a reaction against that, and having someone like Chavez come in and overthrow a very, very corrupt regime. President Perez of Venezuela was president of Venezuela, probably became the wealthiest man in Latin America. We don't have exact statistics, but it looks as though as president of a country, he became phenomenally wealthy, huge corruption. And that opened the door for Chavez to step in. Chavez stepped in and began to nationalize things, and the rich people were told to pay taxes, the ones that owned businesses. They left. They hated Chavez because they didn't want to pay taxes. This was new to them. They didn't like the policies, the socialism that went on. And now we've got a guy like Maduro who does not have the charisma that Chavez had. Chavez had tremendous charisma. He made a lot of mistakes. I'm not defending the man. I'm just saying he implemented these policies that really were set out to favor the lower and middle classes. And he made a lot of mistakes, but he was very, very popular, very charismatic. Maduro has made lots of mistakes, and he's not charismatic. He's not so popular. So it's a lot easier to oppose him. And all the big oil interests, the United States, I mean, we are opposed to this person because he doesn't toe the line. He doesn't play the game that we want him to play. On the other side of the coin, there's a fear that we could lose the Middle Eastern oil fields because of the wars that are going on there, because of the strength of ISIS. Despite what we are told, ISIS is very powerful in the Middle East, and they may win. Trump announced yesterday or the day before that he's sending more troops into Afghanistan, but so far our policies in Afghanistan, Syria, Iraq have been an abysmal failure. So Venezuela has all this oil, and the oil companies keep a close eye on what's going on there. They don't really want to interfere and cause havoc, like the kinds of havoc that's been caused in parts of the Middle East. So it's a very complex issue. And, of course, playing along with that is the fact that everybody understands that the price of oil is probably going to go down and stay down, that oil needs to be replaced and is being replaced by solar and wind, especially solar, and other forms of energy that will come along and replace it. So it's very complex here what's going on in Venezuela. But the only thing we know about Venezuela, really, is it's an extremely sad situation. Here you had a country that was one of the most successful economies, the most successful economy in Latin America, that's been basically destroyed.
Yeah, it's... I just wanted to get your insight into that, and I'm sorry for overwhelming you. I get a little excited, and I start to like just go off on these different, kind of tangents. But yeah, I was thinking about you when I thought about Venezuela, just because it seems that it's not just Venezuela, but there are these sort of Central and South American nations that have begun to resist. And I guess this started happening a little while ago, but they began to resist these sort of economic slavery, I guess, or the debts that were put on them by the IMF or some other sort of organization like that. like you said, you know, you go into, like you did when you were an economic hitman, you'd go into these nations and basically offer them a deal that they were not meant to refuse. And these countries are then put in this awful position where they can't, it's almost impossible for them to get out from under the boot of empire of the United States and other corporations' influence and control. And do you see any hope in regards to maybe specific countries or maybe a movement of nations, you know, moving away from that sort of control and influence by the United States and its corporate allies?
There was such a movement when Chavez was overthrown in a CIA coup in 2002, and then he was very, very clever and came back into power. He resisted the CIA coup. Mm-hmm. That sent a very strong message throughout Latin America that the United States was a paper tiger, because he not only resisted the coup, but then the Bush administration didn't go in and do anything. And I think they didn't do that because they were so bogged down in the Middle East, and again, where they didn't want to lose the possibility of Venezuelan oil. In any case, after that, 10 countries in Latin America went from military dictatorships to basically democratic reform. There was a huge movement that was inspired by Chavez. Whatever you may think of Chavez, he had a huge impact on history. That's diminishing now. The economic hitman, the CIA, have been in there very, very strongly, overthrew President Zelaya of Honduras several years ago because he stood up to Chiquita and Dole. He increased minimum wages by 60%, and he instituted land reform that had a huge negative impact on those big U.S. corporations and a very positive impact on his people. He was then overthrown in a coup. There was an attempted coup against Correa, President Correa of Ecuador. It failed, and I think it was intended to fail, but I could go into that in detail, but I won't right now, but I think it was intended to fail, but it sent a message to Correa, so he backed off his anti-oil policies and became very pro-oil. We've seen huge movements to the right in Argentina and Brazil and many other countries. So what happened in 2002 when Chavez overcame the attempted coup, actually it was a successful coup for a few hours, inspired amazing movements in Latin America. But the economic hitman, the CIA, the jackals have done a pretty good job of turning that around. And so we're seeing a reversal now in Latin America, which I think is unfortunate and very, very sad.
Yeah, I've been seeing a little bit of that as well. And I didn't know really what was going on, because there seemed like there was some resistance and, an attempt to move away from this sort of these coercive tactics that were being used by the United States and other corporations. So, yeah, it's unfortunate. I mean, I really hope that the people of South and Central America can get out of that, because, you know, I think that what's happening right now in the United States with, you know, Donald Trump as president and the Republican Party being in control, and not just the Republican Party, it's the Democratic Party too, but just the state of affairs, it just seems very apparent to me that the United States is losing its control and its influence in the world. And the United States, of course, has used various means, like you've demonstrated, various means of maintaining control over nation states and their economies. But, you know, with somebody like Trump, I think it's an example that not only is our culture and our society beginning to, I think it's a good indication that we're in decline, but it's also something that's just been analyzed by various experts that, you know, the United States doesn't have the same amount of influence that it had even a decade ago or even two decades ago. And, I mean, what do you think the long-term trend is here?
Well, we've blown it. The United States has blown it. When the Soviet Union dissolved in 1991, we had an amazing opportunity to really show the world how a good democracy should work and how capitalism can work, good capitalism. We did the opposite. We went out and exploited the world. Our corporations exploited the world. Our government supported that. And that's come back to haunt us now. It's unfortunate. I think I'm a very loyal American. I hate to see this happening. That's why I write books and get on programs like this to convince people we need to turn this around now. We need to show the world how we can turn a death economy, which we really have created, into a life economy. So we are in decline. There's no question about it. And at the same time, China is very much on the rise, and China's highly respected throughout Latin America. China's making some very important investments in supporting governments and not sending in military troops. My friends who are in high government positions throughout Latin America will say, well, we'd much rather side with China because they don't have a history of overthrowing our governments or assassinating our leaders like you do. You've assassinated Allende in Chile, in Arbenz, in Guatemala, in Roldos in Ecuador, and so on and so forth. This long, long history. China doesn't have that kind of history. They don't have a military presence. We've had military bases in Latin America for years. We had the Monroe Doctrine and Manifest Destiny that outright stated the United States has a right to do whatever we want in the Americas, all the Americas. So China has been smart. It obviously wants many of the same things that we want, which is copper, oil, gold, other natural resources, and it is exploiting those. And I hate to see that happening, but it's doing it. It's learned from us. It's doing it in a way that's not quite as obnoxious as the way we did it. And I think it's very unfortunate that we lost a huge opportunity to show the world a beautiful way of promoting democracy and a good form of capitalism, but we didn't do it. And so the void has been filled, is being filled. And for me, the solution is for our corporations to take a lead in creating new type of economy, what I call a life economy, that's based on cleaning up pollution. It's based on paying a decent rate of return to investors and investing in things that clean up pollution, that regenerate destroyed environments, that use new technologies that don't dig up the earth, that recycle, that draw on the wind and the air and the sun and so on and so forth. Technologies that we haven't even thought about yet. That take us out of this system that's consuming itself into extinction, that's obviously a failure. The United States has an opportunity here to lead the world in that regard. We're losing it fast. China's stepping in. We need to wake up.
and especially with these sort of the ideologues that are in the Trump administration that are very much in, you know, they don't even believe that climate change is real, or at least if they do, they're not acknowledging it. And they're,
I think that Trump is showing us our shadow side. It's been there for a long time. And the gift that Trump is giving us, and I certainly didn't vote for him and wouldn't vote for him. I'm not defending the man at all, but he's given us a gift of seeing our shadow. And people around this country are waking up now, including very conservative people, Republicans who want a Republican in the White House. You know, they're getting extremely disgusted by Trump, but he's showing us a shadow side of ourselves. And I think it's important that we take a good look at that.
I think that that's the, I think that's a difficult thing for a lot of people because they relied on their affiliation with the political party. Like if you're a Republican, you have certain values and you know that your Republican presidential candidate or representative in Congress is going to represent those values regardless of, you know, there might be some differences, of course, among each of them, but you get a general idea of what they're going to do. But I think Trump, he kind of throws the whole thing off. And I think that people that did vote for him based purely on the fact that he was the Republican candidate are now seeing that that what they thought was true is not true anymore. You know, that there's this new that the old ways of thinking about things is not working anymore. And that works both on that level, but with politics, but also on, I think, on deeper systemic levels as well, you know. And like you said, this economy is a death economy. It's killing us. It's killing the planet, and it's very obvious. And you have to be in a kind of extreme form of denial in order to not acknowledge that. And I see some people that are like that. I see a lot of people actually that are still in this sort of state of denial regarding not just Trump, but also what our economy and what our whole system of affairs is really doing to our planet and our climate and you know, what we're kind of giving over to the future generations. And, you know, it's happening very rapidly too. So, you know, I don't know how much longer people can kind of pretend that nothing is happening. So I don't know how much time you have, John. I know I was kind of given a sort of a time frame of about a half an hour.
Yeah, so, I've got another interview coming up very shortly, so we're going to have to stick to that time frame.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Well, John, if you wouldn't mind maybe going over some information that you'd like to share, you know, your any way people can contact you or find your organization, anything like that, that would be great.
I'd really encourage people to go to my website, johnperkins.org. And sign up for my newsletter. You actually got to put your email in there. It comes out once a month. Mm-hmm. Don't overwhelm people, but I think they're pretty good. Sign up for that. I'm also on Facebook and Twitter. And I, you know, do a lot of workshops and speaking engagements. This coming weekend, I'm speaking in Omaha, Nebraska, and then later in Cincinnati and upstate New York. And it's all on my website. So I'd love to meet some of your listeners. And have them subscribe to the newsletter. I take people on trips to the indigenous people in December, Colombia. I think that's trip full to the Kogi, but in January to the Mayan people in the jungles of Guatemala, and nominal trips. So go to my website and come have. I invite all your listeners to come. I want to meet them.
I would like to meet you someday. I really appreciate your time. And hopefully maybe we can do a more in-depth interview at some point in the future. So thank you, though. I really appreciate your time. And
thank you, Patrick. Have a great day.
All right. Thank you.
Yeah. Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to Last Born in the Wilderness. Have a wonderful week. And as a psychedelic bard, Terrence McKenna said, "Take it easy, dude, but take it."